The Epstein files are shining light on the crime of child sex trafficking, but children continue to be exploited across the country and around the world. So what can state legislatures do to help survivors? One national nonprofit says lawmakers in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana could be doing a whole lot more. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about why all three of those states got failing grades for how they protect children who've been trafficked and hear recommendations to help survivors are Shared Hope International Director of Policy Strategy, Sarah Benson, and Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association Executive Director, Lou Tobin. Thank you both so much for being here today. Sarah, how does Shared Hope International define child sex trafficking, and how prevalent is this crime?
Shared Hope defines child sex trafficking as the buying and selling of a sex act with a child. So in other words, anytime a child is engaged in commercial sex, that is child sex trafficking. It's nearly impossible from our perspective to quantify, though, the how much child sex trafficking exists in any one state, let alone across the country, for a number of reasons. We know that the population of young people who are most impacted by exploitation are often the ones who have other experiences that would result in a misidentification, or they are missing entirely and often underreported or unreported when they go from missing from care. It's also a form of a crime that in itself is illicit, and it's really hard to identify exploitation simply because it doesn't exist in the open. It also has a lot of misperceptions, both in terms of the general population, but even among stakeholders who are charged with investigating and prosecuting exploitation. There's some misperceptions that result in a lack of identification. But even more challenging, I would say, is the fact that there are inconsistent definitions of trafficking from state to state and definitions of trafficking that conflict with the federal definition of trafficking. And so we are reticent to point to any one statistic that would demonstrate the prevalence of exploitation. But with that said, there are some really helpful pieces of research and data that we can pull from that research that can help paint a more clear picture of trafficking of children in the U.S. And one point of research that I feel comfortable pointing to is a student survey out of the state of Minnesota that surveys young people in 5th, 8th, 9th, and 11th grade regarding different experiences that they've had in their childhood and at the present time when the survey is administered. And beginning in 2018, one of the questions that they began posing to 9th and 11th graders is whether they had ever traded sex for something of value. And then the survey went on to define what something of value is. So it could be access to housing or a substance or food. In 2025, so the latest year that this survey was administered, 242 11th graders and 205 9th graders responded in the affirmative that they had traded sex for something of value. And that's just those students who happen to be in school on that day, and of course, limited to 9th and 11th graders. If we were to extrapolate and assume similar findings of 10th and 12th graders in Minnesota, that's almost 1,000 high school students who, again, were in school on that day and self-identified. I think we can safely extrapolate further and assume that Minnesota youth are not unique, and that this is probably reflective of the experiences of youth generally across the U.S. And even controlling for population size and different demographics of youth across the U.S., I feel that we can safely and even conservatively hypothesize that approximately 50,000 high school age students have experiences of some form of commercial exploitation. We know that young people with different identities and different experiences experience trafficking at a much higher degree, particularly young people who have experiences of housing insecurity or who are unhoused, and particularly unhoused youth who also identify as LGBTQ, that those rates and prevalence numbers tend to be much higher.
Oh, just shocking to think of just thousands and thousands of teenagers across the country, you know, potentially experiencing this. Lou, I mentioned Jeffrey Epstein in the introduction of this conversation, and there's been a lot of news coverage of the Epstein files. A lot of that coverage talks about, you know, his island and his private jets, but child sex trafficking happens in all kinds of ways. What kinds of cases do Ohio prosecutors typically encounter when it comes to child sex trafficking?
Yeah, I think these are complex cases for minors, whether it's adults who are the victims. They're complex cases to investigate. They're complex cases to prosecute. I think most of them are not quite as complex as what was going on with Jeffrey Epstein. But, you know, we still have situations where there are multiple layers of organizational structure between the people who are being trafficked and between the human trafficker who's at the head of the organization. You have victims who are afraid to cooperate with law enforcement, who are unwilling to cooperate with law enforcement, who may not even view themselves as victims, who may at one point in time be prepared to testify against the person who's trafficking them, and at a later point in time have gone back to the trafficker and no longer be willing to testify against them. That it's complex because the control is psychological rather than physical. And I think often when you present these cases to a jury, the jury is looking for evidence of physical harm or physical captivity, and that's not always there. So, you know, I think a lot of times prosecutors are left charging the people who are engaging in this stuff with other crimes. You know, certainly we want to prosecute them for trafficking in persons when we can, but they're people who are often engaged in a lot of other illegal activity that's causing destruction to their victims and destruction to their communities. And so, you know, we've had cases where we've prosecuted people for compelling prostitution, promoting prostitution, drug trafficking, drug possession, theft, fraud, weapons offenses, and other sex offenses, just to hold them accountable so that we're holding them accountable for something. But these are very complex cases.
We're talking about how Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana protect children who've been commercially sexually exploited. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sarah, your organization produces report cards to grade how states are doing when it comes to laws that protect and support survivors of child sex trafficking. What are the top priorities there for your group?
Yeah, Shared Hope has been evaluating state statutory frameworks since 2011. And for the first 9 years that we evaluated states' laws, we were looking at the state statute framework in a more comprehensive light. So we were looking at the tools that law enforcement and prosecutors had to hold offenders accountable. We were looking at survivors' access to justice, both in the civil and the criminal legal systems. We were looking at youth serving systems' ability to respond. And following that kind of first set of evaluations and grades that we conducted under the framework, under our statutory, or the framework that we use to evaluate states' laws, we found this disconnect between strong grades. Most of the country by 2019 had earned an A or B grade, and the experiences of young people in regards to their ability to be identified as a trafficking survivor. Even more critically, how the state was positioned to respond to their experiences of exploitation and their needs following the harm that they had experienced. We had states that had earned A and B grades, yet were actively prosecuting children for prostitution or other offenses related to their victimization. And so in the early 2020, 2023, we embarked on an intensive engagement and legal research process to uncover what are the protections that young people are facing barriers to access, and what are the protections that are most meaningful, both in terms of ensuring their short-term safety and needs, but also ensuring that they are being positioned for long-term success and holistic safety. So with that, we narrowed our focus and further narrowed the kind of rubric that we utilize to evaluate states' laws, and really began honing in on state laws that ensure that child sex trafficking victims are not unjustly prosecuted for offenses related to their victimization, including the inherent crime of prostitution, that there is meaningful access to resentencing and post-conviction relief when a young person has been prosecuted for offenses related to their victimization, and equally as important, that they have access to high quality and low barrier funded services within their community. And so we now, under our report cards framework, look at 10 points of law that does exactly that, protects against the unjust criminalization of survivors, and ensures that there's an alternative and strong response in place that is able to meet the comprehensive needs and the needs and desires of young people who have experienced trafficking victimization. I will also just say that more recently, we have been moving towards a place of ensuring that state statutes are readied and enabling stakeholders to effectively meet the needs of child sex trafficking victims, but also utilizing our bodies of law to prevent exploitation. And I think that there is such an immense opportunity to utilize state legislation and state statute to begin to address the risk factors and vulnerability factors that lend towards exploitation. I personally believe, and Charito believes, that child sex trafficking is not inevitable, and that there is a really important role for statutes to meaningfully address the risk factors that lend to exploitation, and more importantly, begin to strengthen the protective factors that would prevent against trafficking. And so under our legal framework that we use to evaluate state laws, we're ensuring that state stakeholders are well equipped with the tools that they need to effectively respond in a way that does not cause unintentional harm to survivors, and that communities are better prepared to prevent exploitation of children.
Well, Sarah, there is so much detail in these report cards. I would encourage listeners who want to know more to go to the Shared Hope International website to really review this in more detail. But I mentioned that Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana all got failing grades on the report cards that your organization issues. Just in the briefest terms you can, where are the laws the weakest in those states, in your view?
Yeah, and one thing I do want to point out is it's so important to me because I have worked really closely with advocates, with prosecutors, with service providers in all three of these states, that our grades are not reflective of these states' responses as a whole, that this is just one small piece of a really big, important puzzle. And so when we say that Ohio and Indiana and Kentucky have earned Fs, that is very specific to 10 points of law that we're examining. I would say all three of these states have well-deserved A's in many other areas in terms of the response to child sex trafficking, both in terms of prevention and response. And I think that is a really important point of clarification. But in terms of opportunities to strengthen protections for survivors under all three of these states' state statutes, I would highly encourage lawmakers to contemplate the opportunities that exist to prevent against the unjust criminalization of survivors. That's an area of commonality that all three of these states have. Now, there are varying degrees of protections that are different for all three of these states. So Indiana prohibits the prosecution of children for prostitution, as does Kentucky. Ohio does not, but Ohio has, for many years now, a alternative response in place that attempts to direct young people to services rather than a formal juvenile justice track, which is really geared towards rehabilitation because of criminal or juvenile delinquent acts that they've committed. But all three of these states, a protections does not extend to offenses more broadly. So again, Ohio does have diversion opportunities for young people who engage in a slew of crimes because of their victimization, but that is different in our point of view from broad non-criminalization protections that prohibit the charging and prosecution of children for offenses related to their victimization. Those expanded non-criminalization protections do not exist in Indiana and Kentucky entirely. There's also an absence of coordinated and funded services across all three of these states. In terms of the service response to young people, they're structured quite differently. Kentucky really roots that service response in its child welfare system. Ohio has adopted a different approach in utilizing juvenile justice to connect young people to services. Our position is that young people are best served within their communities by community-based providers who are best positioned to both respond to risk factors before exploitation occurs and effectively meet the needs of young people without needing to involve them in systems and involve their families in systems needlessly. And so Ohio, I will say, in comparison to Indiana, Kentucky, has taken a really important route in appropriating significant state funding. I believe it was almost $5 million this past legislative year to strengthen service providers' ability to meet the needs of young people within communities and position stakeholders to respond effectively to the crime of exploitation. But that is something that I would argue needs to be broadly expanded in all three of these states so that each community is well-funded and well-positioned to respond to the needs of children generally, but then of course to this population specifically.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, a new study looks at alternatives to medication for treating children with depression. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our conversation about how laws in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana do and do not protect children who have been commercially sexually exploited. My guests are Shared Hope International Director of Policy Strategy, Sarah Benson, and Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association Executive Director, Lou Tobin. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Lou, I know Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has made fighting human trafficking a priority. What are some of the most important tools Ohio prosecutors have to really prosecute these crimes?
Yeah, and you know, it has been a priority for our association too, and I'm really proud of the work that we've done with our legislature to address child sexual exploitation and adult sexual exploitation. We've worked closely with the General Assembly to create what Sarah was talking about earlier, our juvenile safe harbor statute, to make sure that when juveniles are engaged in some of these activities, we're making sure that they're filtered into a treatment track once they're brought into the juvenile justice system so that they're getting the help that they need rather than just languishing in a juvenile detention facility. We've worked closely with them, with the legislature on the adoption of our trafficking in persons statute, the enactment of it, increasing the penalties for promoting prostitution. We've worked closely to make sure that people have appropriate opportunities who have been victims of human trafficking to seal and expunge their records. I want to respond a little bit to the report card, because I think it's important for people to understand, one, that this is an advocacy tool for this one particular organization to achieve the policy goals that it has set out. You know, it's not tied to any accreditation for Ohio or any type of funding for Ohio. It's no different than a scorecard that other entities like the Chamber of Commerce or the NRA would use to grade legislators or legislatures. And so this is just a means for Shared Hope to achieve its policy goals. And that's fine. It's an effective policy tool. People are entitled to advocate however they want to advocate. But I think some of the stuff that's in this report is not necessarily reflective of where we are in Ohio. One of the things it criticizes us for is not criminalizing buyers within our human trafficking statute. And while that's technically true, we do criminalize them under a different statute, which is our compelling prostitution statute, which can also be a felony of the first degree. The report card is critical of us for not allowing for record expungement for any offense. We allow record expungement here for everything except aggravated murder, murder, and rape. And we just think that those are three crimes that the public doesn't want erased. And it would be really unfair to the victims of a murder, their loved ones, or the victim of a rape to expunge those crimes and pretend like they never happened. The other thing in the report card, and Sarah talked about this idea of decriminalizing things, I think, frankly, that's a dangerous suggestion. The idea that we would decriminalize other felonies that are being committed by people just because they're sex trafficking victims is dangerous for minors, one, because it's creating an incentive for criminal enterprises and human trafficking enterprises to recruit minors to do the work for them because they know the minors are not going to be held accountable for that. And, you know, it's also important, I think, for your listeners to understand that combating human trafficking and helping the victims of human trafficking are things that are really critical to prosecutors and to our association. But we have a duty to promote public safety more broadly. We have a duty to seek justice for crime victims. And we can't just allow people to go around committing crime, and in particular, violent crime, with zero accountability. And so the suggestion that we just shouldn't hold people accountable for whatever they do, we don't think the public agrees with that. We don't think that the victims of crimes that are being committed by people who are being subjected to human trafficking, we don't think they would necessarily agree with that. So we want to be supportive of the victims of human trafficking, but we can't just decriminalize everything that they're engaged in and allow them to go around without accountability in our communities.
Sarah, would you like to respond briefly to that?
Yeah, these are concerns that we've heard. It's not the first time I've heard these concerns, and there's validity to it in the sense that unless there is I would say two things. There's, I think, a misperception that survivors of trafficking who engage in conduct have the mens rea to be able to, they're exercising decision-making when they engage in criminal activity. I would also say there's, I think, a misperception, not necessarily from Lou, but from the general population, that providing non-criminalization protections to survivors of trafficking is not an easy protection to provide, in the sense of it's left to the court to decide whether or not there's actually a nexus between the victimization and the criminal conduct, whether or not that exists and is sufficient enough so that the non-criminalization protection would exist. I would also argue, from what we've seen in states that do have broad non-criminalization protections for survivors, that these protections, of course, are imperative for understanding and recognizing and affirming the experiences of children, but they're also a really important tool for law enforcement and prosecutors, because when we stop focusing on the low-hanging fruit and the easy scapegoats, which are child sex trafficking victims, there are better opportunities to hold the actual offenders, the buyers, the traffickers, the people who are positioning these young people to engage in criminal conduct, to hold them accountable in a way that is appropriate, in a way that actually does secure safety for the community at large. We have seen time and time and time again, 15, 16, 17-year-olds being prosecuted both as juveniles and as adults in the criminal legal system for offenses that are directly related to their victimization. And I would argue that has not made our communities any safer. In fact, that has made safety for that young person at jeopardy, because they will not be held forever. They will be released, and there are years and decades of trauma that have to be remedied and addressed once they are released. But the person who was behind the offense, that was behind that young person's exploitation, who positioned them to engage in that criminal conduct, was likely not held accountable. And I can think of many young people that I have worked with, that our organization has advocated for, in which they were the only person held criminally accountable for the acts that really were really reflective of another adult in their life. And so we have seen these laws be enormously effective, both, of course, for survivors, but for and also for the juvenile justice system, the child welfare system, the criminal legal system. It really is a tool for everyone to ensure community safety and to ensure that we are providing trauma-informed and survivor-centered protections for child sex trafficking victims.
And Lou, I know you talked earlier about how prosecutors work diligently to hold perpetrators, you know, to account. We do have a couple of questions that listeners have emailed in. Steve from Oakley asks, is the pursuit of the perpetrator easier or harder in this digital age? Lou, what do you think about that?
That's a great question. And the answer is, I think both. I think the fact that we have digital evidence makes the pursuit of these people, I don't want to say easier, but it gives us a better avenue that we can rely on to pursue human traffickers, that where we don't have to necessarily just rely on the testimony of one of the victims. And because of the issues that we have with victim cooperation, digital evidence in these cases is critical. And so I think the fact that we have the digital trails that we have today is extremely helpful. The downside is I think the internet creates a lot more opportunity for this to go on to begin with. We've seen explosions over the last 24 months in child sexual abuse material online because of artificial intelligence. There are all sorts of issues, you know, with the dark web, and our ability to track criminals through the dark web and their use of cryptocurrency to engage in the conduct that they're engaging in, and how we can track them down when they use cryptocurrency. So there are benefits and there's a downside to it too.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I've been talking with Shared Hope International Director of Policy Strategy, Sarah Benson, and Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association Executive Director, Lou Tobin. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, a new study looking at alternatives to medication for treating children with depression and anxiety. This is Cincinnati Edition.